From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last night was President Obama's fifth State of the Union address. He asked for an increase in the minimum wage, for immigration reform. He defended Obamacare and the Iran nuclear talks, and an America of opportunity for all, he said. And he went after congressional resistance, saying he will do what he can through executive order if Congress fails to act.
America does not stand still, and neither will I. So wherever and whenever I can take steps without legislation to expand opportunity for more American families, that's what I'm going to do.
This hour on Point, the State of the Union, the President's address, and where this White House and Washington go now. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did the President's speech capture the country as you see it? What do you think of his agenda? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Kristen Welker, White House correspondent for NBC News. Kristen, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you with us today.
Hey, Tom, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
From New York, Raihan Salam is with us, writer for the National Review and Reuters Opinion. Raihan, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom.
And from New York, Amy Davidson is here, senior editor at The New Yorker. Amy Davidson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, and thanks for having me.
It's great to have all three of you here. Let's dive right into the president. He started off with his bragging list. Here he is, the USA, the State of the Union.
Tonight, this chamber speaks with one voice to the people we represent. It is you, our citizens, who make the state of our union strong.
Oh, yeah, you, the citizens, and here, the bragging list, sorry.
The lowest unemployment rate in over 5 years, a rebounding housing market, a manufacturing sector that's adding jobs for the first time since the 1990s, more oil produced at home than we buy from the rest of the world, the first time that's happened in nearly 20 years. Our deficits cut by more than half. And for the first time in over a decade, business leaders around the world have declared that China is no longer the world's number one place to invest. America is.
And the president went on to say that no nation on earth is better positioned for the 21st century. Amy Davidson at the top, and of course all presidents do it, but right there, happy days are here again. Were you persuaded by the president?
Well, you know, it's interesting because he talked about what you, the citizens, can do. And part of the speech was all about what he would do even without Congress. But one of his messages seemed to be that that was fairly limited, that there wasn't so much the president could do, that a lot of this would have to happen in a more diffuse way. It was modest in its optimism, both about the country and about his own power as president to really change the country. And it ended on a very downbeat and yet emotionally resonant note with a soldier, Corey Remsburg, who was badly wounded in Afghanistan and was there sitting next to Michelle Obama, having gone through rehab, dozen surgeries. And the president seemed to be saying, this is the sort of accomplishment we're hoping for. It's struggle, it's hard what we're doing, but we're going to, you know, go step by step ahead. But it wasn't so much a sweeping, joyous speech in that sense.
Waves of applause at the end, but for a wounded soldier, far more at that point than for a nation poised for greatness in the 21st century. Raihan Salam, what's the situation that you saw the president confronting last night? Here he is, his legislative agenda in this last year. Big stuff, basically went nowhere. And so he comes before Congress and the country. How did you read the country and the presidency that he's presenting?
Well, ultimately, State of the Union addresses don't make a very big difference in terms of public opinion. They don't seem to make a very big difference in terms of resetting relationships with Congress. I think that what the president was trying to do with a speech that was relatively restrained, relatively modest, was attempt a reset. For example, many people had anticipated that the speech would be very combative, very aggressive, and it wasn't that. In fact, he actually referenced an idea from Republican Senator Marco Rubio favorably. He was offering offering fig leaves. I think he was trying to change the page in that regard, which I think made sense given that there's frankly not a huge amount that he can do with a speech like this. As to the broader question of where the country is, I think it is absolutely true that America is unusually resilient and the United States is well positioned relative to other major economies. That doesn't mean that the country is not suffering, particularly the long-term unemployed. So I think that it's a mixed bag, but I think it's absolutely true that you'd rather be the United States than a wide array of other countries, the Eurozone, than China, et cetera.
Kristen, we'll look at the president's proposals, but help us think through the White House lens and how they saw the challenge last night and how you saw the strategy that was rolled out in the president's address.
Well, I think it was about a reset. Certainly, he had a rocky 2013, so he wanted to set the tone for 2014. But I think that modest was the word of the night. I mean, his big proposal that he announced, his executive action to increase the minimum wage to $10.10 for contractors, only impacts a couple of 100,000 people. So I think it underscores his limits, the limitations of his own office, what he can realistically accomplish, and what this Congress is realistically willing to do. I also think that what was interesting, you saw one moment of bipartisanship when he talked about immigration reform. So of all of the policies that he laid out, talked about last night, I think the one possibility, and I stress the word possibility, for potential compromise or at least finding common ground could be on immigration reform. You saw some Republicans start to applaud when he talked about the need to pass immigration reform. But again, I do think this was a president who's dealing with the realities of his office. I would also point out that he was in a way setting up the tone for the 2014 campaigns, painting Republicans as unsympathetic to the middle class. That's why you heard him talk about income inequality, this emphasis on the minimum wage, and also things like unemployment insurance benefits.
And saying to Congress, give America a raise. That sounds like a campaign line if there ever was one. Here he was asking for not just for federal employees, but for all Americans, a $10.10 minimum wage.
$10.10. It's easy to remember. 10-10. This will help families. It'll give businesses customers with more money to spend. It does not involve any new bureaucratic program. So join the rest of the country. Say yes. Give America a raise. Give them a raise.
Amy, is this what we're going to debate for the rest of the year? A minimum wage, whether it goes from $7.25 to $10.10? Is that it?
I think so. I think one of the key phrases in the clip you just played is join the rest of the country. He's calling for this increase in the minimum wage when a lot of states have already acted, a lot of localities have already acted, when there's really already a drive. He's not so much in front of this as, you know, catching the wave of his own party, his own base, and a lot, and beyond that, of the public. There's a growing almost consensus that certain wages are too low, and this is a problem that, as you said, if you have a family where the parents are working full-time, they shouldn't be struggling as much as people with that wage are, that Ronald Reagan quickly approved a minimum wage that in real terms was higher than what we have now. So that is a little bit in the spirit of this whole speech, this kind of joining in and pushing forward a little bit. And I think it's interesting, you know, he did get a lot of applause when he talked about immigration reform, but he was also pretty vague on that. All he really said was, we're going to fix our broken immigration system. The real fight over what that means, how that's going to be done, he saved that for another speech, not this one. And the one area that I think was really missing in this speech was gun control, which was such a focus last year. Gabby Giffords there, and he passed so quickly over it in this speech. There seemed to just be a sense that that was something that he couldn't sort of gather forces that were already out there to get done, and it just, as a result, was not going to get done, which I think really depressed a lot of people who cared about that issue.
Join the rest of the country on minimum wage, he said, Rayhan Salam, but everyone we hear looking at the vote says there's no way that's going to pass the House. What about immigration? Do you see real possibility there for some deal or deals with the GOP?
I think that there's a possibility for some kind of deal, but briefly on the minimum wage, there are a couple of things worth noting, one of which is that a majority of Republican voters endorse an increase in the minimum wage, mm-hmm. which makes this a very effective wedge issue for the president. So if it were up to him, I guarantee you that it would be what we'd be talking about for the next year. It's also true, however, that last year in his last State of the Union, he talked about a $9 minimum wage. This time he's talking about $10.10, which speaks to some degree to how much thought has gone into the proposal. So I think that there are a lot of complications, and there are a lot of people who worry that while it might not lead to job losses, it might reduce net job growth. So I think that there are a lot of concerns here, and there are a lot of Republicans who are really struggling with what to do about a proposal that is very popular politically, but that might actually prove pretty problematic in terms of its consequences, particularly for vulnerable members. Of the population. So with regard to immigration reform, you know, I think that here's another area where there are some really, really big complications, one of which is that, you know, there's this emerging consensus that we ought to legalize the unauthorized immigrant population. There are some who want a path to citizenship and some who say, including many so-called dreamers, many of the young Americans who came to the United States as minor children, as unauthorized immigrants, who are saying, wait a second. A path to legality is more important to a path to citizenship. The thing is that when you're looking at this unauthorized immigrant population, it's very, very poor. And so absorbing this population, you know, will be quite costly.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president's State of the Union address, the country, the presidency, and the year ahead in Washington with Amy Davidson, senior editor at The New Yorker, Raihan Salam, writer for The National Review, and Kristen Welker, White House correspondent for NBC News. You can join us this hour. Does President Obama have the right analysis of where we are, the right priorities, prescription for this year? Can you imagine standing there addressing a Congress that said no so much? Does the president have it right on minimum wage, immigration, education, Iran? This could be, he said, a breakthrough year.
That's why I believe this can be a breakthrough year for America. After 5 years of grit and determined effort, the United States is better positioned for the 21st century than any other nation on earth.
Positioned, but opportunity not spread widely enough, not equally enough. Here's the president.
Today, after 4 years of economic growth, corporate profits and stock prices have rarely been higher. And those at the top have never done better. But average wages have barely budged. Inequality has deepened. Upward mobility has stalled. The cold hard fact is that even in the midst of recovery, too many Americans are working more than ever just to get by, let alone to get ahead.
So executive orders. Amy Davidson, if you look at these orders, what looks promising to you? I mean, if he really won't be able to get much of anything through Congress, and he's kind of conceding that in this speech.
Yeah.
Is there net-net enough to move the needle on the Obama agenda in these executive orders?
I think he can move the needle, but a lot of what he wants to do is, in a way, almost treat executive orders as a laboratory for other change. That's the case, again, with the minimum wage, where he's saying, you know, private companies can look at what we're doing with contractors and they'll see what a good idea it is, you know, to change the market, to change the context. Maybe that will work in that extent. One thing that he did was clever when talking about the minimum wage was saying, you know, the people who cook for our troops, who do the laundry for our troops, do better, to sort of connect it to a sort of idea of national security and what soldiers deserve. And that again, is part of the role that Corey Remsburg played in this speech. In terms of, you know, it being a breakthrough year and putting part of that, I think, is really putting last year behind him, which didn't go so well. Probably the most priceless moment in the speech was the look on Kathleen Sebelius's face, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, when Obama said that he wasn't sure he'd ever really convinced the Republicans that the Affordable Care Act had been a good idea and that maybe we could move forward from just the attempts to repeal it. But, you know, 2013 was kind of rotten for Obama between the problems with the rollout, with the NSA revelations, not getting things through Congress, gun control dying. And in a way, breakthrough year is almost feels more like a break away from all that year, and where he'll just sort of sit at his desk and try to get some things done. Whether that's really a breakthrough in terms of changing the direction of the country is kind of a more complicated question.
Kristen Welker, it was almost painful to see the way the president turned or had to turn, all respect to the military service, but the way he would turn there for applause lines, even on the minimum wage, and certainly to get that big ovation at the end of his speech, it was the go-to button to press to make that hall applaud. Now, fine for the applause, but it's not Egypt after all. We've got more than a military agenda in this country.
Right. I think that's a great point. It was as if that was really the only thing on which both parties could really agree and really give a robust applause for. I think that's a great characterization. I think part of the president's strategy with these executive actions, though, Tom, is to try to pressure Congress to get something done. So not just to give the private sector ideas about how they might improve things for their workers, but also to try to pressure Congress. It's a risky strategy, though, because I've been talking to some moderate Republicans who say, look, we want to find ways to work with the president, but these executive actions are in a way gearing Congress up for a fight with the White House. So I think that it does carry some risk. And as we've been saying, he set out pretty modest proposals last night.
I mean, Reihan, there's been a lot of criticism from conservatives of his turning to executive action here. Even we heard Ted Cruz calling it extra legal or words to that effect. I mean, the word dictator gets thrown around here. But there's been a big history of executive order use, has there not, by the White House over time?
There has, and I think that what you'll tend to find is that the party out of power, the party that is out of the White House, tends to be critical of the expansion of executive authority. We certainly saw this during the Bush years, and now during the Obama years, it's Republicans who tend to be more critical of it. That said, there have been some moves, when it comes to administrative discretion in, for example, the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and also with regards to immigration enforcement that have struck some observers as being particularly egregious, that have struck some observers as essentially being policy changes rather than mere changes when it comes to administrative enforcement. And again, we're not going to be able to adjudicate that here. But I think that some of those concerns are reasonable. And I think that for Democrats, we ought to think about, what are the precedents that are being set? So, when you have another Republican president, were a Republican president to use this kind of administrative discretion in implementing laws that had been passed under Democratic administrations, what might that mean?
Let's go to Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Well, first of all, there won't be another Republican president in our lifetime, not nationally, if you keep alienating everyone in the country other than white evangelical 55-year-old men. So we can push that aside. Number two, I find it funny and kind of hypocritical with Republicans complaining about Obama being a dictator and this, that, and the other, when George W. Bush had 170-something executive orders, and Ronald Reagan, you remember him, Emperor Reagan the first, he had over 200 executive orders. And me personally, as a supporter of the president, I think that he should do many more. I think that at this point he should have well over 200 executive orders when you factor in the fact that during the inauguration night of the man, as he's dancing away, becoming the 44th president, there was a conspiracy to deny him anything, any achievement of his presidency.
Carl, let me ask you something, Carl. I mean, you're quite right. Obama, in his first term, fewer than George W. Bush, far fewer than Ronald Reagan. But here he is. As you watched him last night, do you see a guy who's been sort of boxed in and diminished by the extent of opposition there? A president who's stuck when he's got 3 years left, Carl?
I see a guy that was in his first term was stunned by the opposition that he even if it would hurt the American people, the Republican opposition and just the say no party that didn't want to get anything done, even things that they had championed, if it was going to help America and help the president, they were flat footed against it. And I see a man last night that's just absolutely saying, you know what? These guys aren't for anything to help our country. So I'm just going to go it alone, America, because these Republicans here, and I'm going to tell you, Tom, history is going to be a horrible, horrible judge on the Republican Party.
Carl, we've got it. Let us pick it up right there. Kristen Welker, take on the state of this presidency at this point. I mean, we've seen second-term presidents before who didn't necessarily have big ideas. We've seen Bill Clinton talk about school uniforms. Yeah. It can be a tough moment. On the other hand, there's 3 years to go here, and the president seemed to be kind of throwing in the towel on convincing, persuading this Congress, and it's by no means clear that the makeup of Congress is going to change in this election to come in his favor. What's the state of this presidency now?
Well, I think there's no doubt that he's frustrated, feels boxed in, as you say. And I think he's also aware of the fact that he doesn't have a whole lot of time left. He has 3 more years of his presidency. But once the 2014 midterm elections get underway, it's going to be increasingly more difficult for him to get anything significant accomplished. So I think that is why you see him laying out these executive actions. By the way, we've been paying a lot of attention to the minimum wage, but later today he's going to announce a new starter savings account, which they're hoping will help millions of people start to save. It's going to be a government-backed savings account. And so I think
this
that's
is
part
my
of why you're
my RA, he was talking
my
about
RA, last night. Exactly, exactly. And I think that's why you're seeing him roll out these executive actions. Having said that, I do think there's going to be a strong push to get some things done with Congress, particularly immigration reform. We've been talking about that, and I just want to add to our conversation on that point. I think the one of the key reasons why they think there may be room for common ground is because House Speaker John Boehner really wants to get something done. A, you had the results of the 2012 election. You saw President Obama running away with 70% of the Latino vote. So Republicans know this is a political problem for them. But I think, and in talking to people in Speaker Boehner's office, he doesn't want to be known as the speaker who didn't get anything accomplished. In other words, presiding over a House that didn't accomplish anything large. So he really wants to get this done. One sign of that, he brought Rebecca Talent on board. That's someone who has been deeply engaged in immigration reform in the past. So that is potentially one place where we might see common ground. But I think you're right. This president feels boxed in. And so he's looking to accomplish modest things at this point.
Amy, do you see a stuck presidency at this point? Do you see a way out of that, or is that too apocalyptic? Can he pull off a year of action in spite of opposition?
I mean, what he seemed to be saying is, yes, I'm wounded, but, you know, if a lot of people are wounded, if this soldier is wounded and he keeps getting up every morning and taking one step, then I'm going to, too. But it is, he wasn't exactly looking for the sort of fights that often drive real change or the real battles that you sometimes do have to engage in. I thought one interesting moment, the other moment of big bipartisan applause, was when he seemed to be starting to talk about issues like gay rights and social justice. He was talking about the dignity and equality of every human being, and then you maybe expect a policy proposal, and instead he said, you know, and what we're going to do about that is next week Team USA is going to march into the Olympic Stadium and
hooray!
Bring home gold, which was, you know, I guess the segue, it made sense in the sense in that there's been a huge issue in Russia with the Olympics and gay rights.
Yeah,
homophobia.
Still.
So there was a transition there, but it was a little jarring. It was, you know, we have these big problems that are also cultural debates, and we're going to make it all work by all cheering together for our athletes in Sochi.
Yeah.
And we will cheer for them, but it didn't really explain how, say, gay marriage is going to be legalized in different states.
So applause for the military, applause for the U.S. Olympic team, but not really going for high principle here or big vision. What do you see, Raihan? Do you see a president hunkering down? And what does it mean if he's hunkering down at this point in his presidency with a lot of time to go?
Well, it's interesting. Your caller had referred to the president as having been blindsided by the extent, by the depth of the opposition to his agenda.
I think many people share that observation.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely true. And I think similarly, George W. Bush was someone who came from Texas and he thought, my gosh, you know, I worked so well with Democrats in Texas. What's going on here? And both Barack Obama and George Bush are people who came from environments that were politically, monolithically one thing or the other. Whereas when you've had other presidents who've managed to pivot somewhat more effectively, they tend to be people who cut their political teeth in environments that were more diverse, where you had, you know, kind of a stronger liberal and conservative
faction. But Obama had a reputation for working with downstate Republicans in Illinois from his time as a legislator there?
He did, and George W. Bush had a terrific reputation for working with Texas Democrats during his, you know, when he was governor as well. So, you know, again, the thing is that that actually means something very different when you're entering the national political space, whereas Bill Clinton is someone who was operating in Arkansas in the 1970s and 1980s in this very different environment in which he had a better understanding, you know, of the nature of the other side's perspective. And I think that that was very useful to him. I think that Barack Obama is someone who takes great pride in the idea that he can understand what the other side is thinking, and yet people on the other side often think, gosh, he's really pretty badly mischaracterizing what we actually think. You know, the president tries to take this Archimedean position that's separate from, you know, those to his left and those to his right. Yeah. And I think a lot of people to his left and to his right find that he doesn't quite get them right.
Amy, what are you thinking there?
I was thinking that it's not so much that Obama has thinks that he knows what the other side is thinking, but he thinks he has a sense of what's actually in the other side's interest, and has an idea that that ought to be enough. Like, it would make sense for them to agree to this. It's good for them, too. And that's not always how politics operates.
Let's go to John in Hadley, Massachusetts. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just had a couple of quick comments. I'm a conservative, but I believe that the minimum wage should be raised to $10, and I think the Republicans need to get out in front of the lynch mob and make it a parade. Now, also, I happen to think that unemployment benefits should be extended. Not for 3 months. I think the Republicans should grab this bull by the horns and demand that the unemployment extension be extended, or unemployment benefits should be extended for, until 2018.
So what makes you a Republican in your view then, John?
Well, I'm not a Republican. I'm a conservative.
Okay.
You make that mistake, so you assume all conservatives are Republicans, but I'm not. I believe that the mere fact that the president is asking for an extension of the unemployment benefits is an abject admission of his failure as a leader on this issue economically. And the Republicans should embrace that idea and utilize that.
Oh, you mean that the economy still needs that extension means Obama's failed in your interpretation, John?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
An abject failure. His economic agenda is too far to the left. And the reason that he, you know, is he's experienced such opposition is not who he is. It's his ideas. They're not palatable to the American people.
John, we've got it. I appreciate your call. One more right here from Lincoln, Nebraska. George is calling. Hi, George. You're on the air. What did you think?
Well, I guess I was thinking that President Obama may be taking the long view that trying to come out and slap the face of the Republicans at this point wouldn't be able to gain much. But over 3 years, if he gently tries to massage some of these ideas through, he may accomplish more.
I mean, that gets back to the old Obama position, kind of get in there and try and work with people. Kristen Welker, does the White House still have this idea that somehow that will work? Don't offend, get in, try and work, and it'll, I mean, after 5 years, that may not be look so likely.
I don't think they see it as a very likely scenario. I don't think they've given up on it altogether. But to the point of your first caller and the economy, I mean, you see Republicans making that, gearing up to make that a big issue in 2014. We heard that last night in the Republican response from Kathy McMorris Rodgers, who really slammed the president's handling of the economy. And then, of course, she also talked about health care. So I think that's going to be another big issue. And what was interesting, though, is what she didn't say about health care. You didn't hear her use the word repeal. I think you're going to see a different strategy from Republicans on that point heading into this year. Instead of talking about repeal, I think they're going to be talking about changing the law. But certainly in terms of working with Republicans, whether or not that's realistic, I think that there's not a whole lot of optimism on that. You remember President Obama had that whole campaign where he was having dinner, lunches with Republicans, meetings at the White House. We haven't seen a whole lot of effort in that direction.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the President's State of the Union address last night with Kristen Welker, White House correspondent for NBC News, Raihan Salam of the National Review, Amy Davidson of the New Yorker. Here was his big finish last night, and it was keyed off the story, the 10 deployments abroad of Sergeant Army Ranger Corey Remsburg, who was there sitting next to the First Lady, almost killed by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan on his 10th deployment, and has struggled back. Here's the president.
My recovery has not been easy, he says. Nothing in life that's worth anything is easy. Corey is here tonight. And like the Army he loves, like the America he serves, Sergeant First Class Corey Remsburg never gives up and he does not quit.
And there the president got his big finish. The applause and standing ovation went on for over 2 minutes for the 10 deployments of Corey Remsburg, but it came right near the end of his speech where he was looking for that finish. Martin in El Paso, Texas. Martin, what do you think?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was calling because I agree 100% with the president raising the minimum wage to 10-10. I make double the minimum wage right now, but I see families, my ex-wife, makes minimum wage, and on top of the money that I have to give for child support, I give her money so my daughters can have a decent life. And I'm thinking, why, if Congress wants to block the president from raising the minimum wage, they should get paid minimum wage. See how it feels to make minimum wage. If they were making minimum wage, they wouldn't be, they would be raising the price. I remember one time I saw the Congress voting on raising their salary, and I didn't see nobody saying nay.
Martin, it's hard to argue with your firsthand experience. Anybody who's been there trying to live on minimum wage knows you're right. If that was $7.25 an hour nationally, I mean, do you think, Raihan Salam, that the Republican opposition to raising this wage will hold up through the course of this year as we head toward the election, 2014 midterm?
I think that the Republican opposition, the problem with it is that you need to offer an alternative. And there are some Republican lawmakers who are offering alternatives. But the question is this. If your concern is raising household incomes for people at the bottom of the distribution, what is the most sensible way to do that? Now, when you talk about raising congressional salaries, taxpayers pay for that. When you talk about raising the minimum wage, there are a lot of different factors at play when you're talking about low-wage employers. And so another strategy that we've used for a long time that's been championed by Republicans and Democrats is providing a wage subsidy in the form of the earned income tax credit.
And how does that work? Just remind people how that works, Raihan.
The idea is that for those who work, you actually receive an amount that is a supplement to your income that can be quite generous if you're someone who has children, and it's much less so if you are a childless worker. And so what a lot of Republicans have been talking about, and something, an idea that the president referenced in his State of the Union address, is that if you're a childless worker, you should also receive a more generous wage subsidy of some kind. Now, the question, there are a lot of questions as to how you might design this wage subsidy. There are many people who believe that the EITC is pretty flawed. But I think that when you look at it this way, you're not just saying that the responsibility for raising wages belongs to a small number of employers. You're saying that the responsibility belongs to the country as a whole and that taxpayers, particularly affluent taxpayers, should bear some of that burden. So I think that when you think about it that way, it makes a lot of sense to pursue some kind of alternative. But I definitely agree that the politics of this issue are very problematic for Republicans who aren't able to offer a viable alternative.
I mean, I wonder if the Republicans will hold up here. The president, yes, he was talking about earned income tax credit. Marco Rubio has been talking about that. But the president was talking both and 1010 and the EITC. Here he was.
I agree with Republicans like Senator Rubio that it doesn't do enough for single workers who don't have kids. So let's work together to strengthen the credit, reward work, help more Americans get ahead.
I mean, there he's saying, let's do both sides of this. Martin in El Paso, Texas says, come on, try it yourself. And you could hear, Raihan, he's not going to be brought around, it doesn't sound to me, on the minimum wage. Of course, there was Kathy McMorris Rogers' Republican response, the official Republican response, Congresswoman from Washington State. And she was talking about kind of traditional, let's say, free markets, go out there, you know, let the government set you free and rise.
So tonight,
well, Tom,
I'd like to share a more hopeful Republican vision, one that empowers you, not the government. It's one that champions free markets and trusts people to make their own decisions, not a government that decides for you. It helps working families rise above the limits of poverty and protects our most vulnerable.
Reihan, the president's got his problems, but Martin has voiced and others what could be a problem for the GOP here too.
You're absolutely right that it's a problem, because I think that both a lot of Republicans and Democrats don't understand the ways in which the country has changed. For example, 9% of American adults have limited English proficiency. That is 80% higher than it was in 1990. So when you're talking about folks who have limited English proficiency, when you're talking about people who are ex-offenders, mass incarceration is another huge problem that leads to immobility at the bottom. When you talk about the scarring effects of long-term unemployment on people's skills, you're talking about a lot of people who are in need of entry-level jobs. And so the question is, does all of the responsibility for helping those guys climb the economic ladder belong to low-wage employers, or does some of it belong to high earners through their tax payments to the federal government? That's
Redistribution, Reihan? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. I'm talking about the kind of redistribution that Ronald Reagan and other Republicans have championed when they championed the EITC. The idea of the EITC is that let's draw people into the workforce, including people who have a variety of challenges that make it difficult for them to find entry-level work. The problem is when you have redistribution that does not primarily emphasize drawing people into the workforce and moving them towards self-reliance and self-sufficiency. And I think if you see
you've got to be in the workforce to make the higher minimum wage. Amy, what about the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit?
I love the EITC. In fact, my family benefited from it when I was a child. It's important. It's one of the greatest anti-poverty measures that we've got. But we can't say it's alone enough or completely take the pressure off of employers and say that, you know, you can get the work of people and not have to pay them what you can live on. I think Martin's experience is so interesting and so more and more widespread. People are looking at people, their neighbors, their relatives, who are working really hard, and it just doesn't feel right to them that they're living in poverty. And I think to just sort of vaguely with the Republicans saying, well, we'll do something with taxes, well, at the same time that Republicans are fighting against any tax increase that might actually pay for that and cutting benefits and cutting the sort of educational spending that can help the children in those families get different sorts of jobs. It's an odd kind of Republican argument. It feels often more like misdirection than actually a anti-poverty plan.
Let's go to our listener.
I'd love to respond to that.
If I could. Sure,
but
Ryan, yes.
Please, go right ahead, Tom.
Well, let me get one more caller on this front. Keep them in the middle of it, and I'll let you, of course, Ryan. Jo Ellen in Marshalltown, Iowa. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi. It's actually Marshalltown.
Yeah.
My question is they can raise the minimum wage all they want, but they need to build in an automatic cost of living raise. I know a lady who's worked at Kmart, and I hate to drop names, but she's worked there 4 or 5 years and still making $7.25 an hour. I know somebody who's working at a big-name grocery store here in the Midwest for 8 years, or no, 15 years, and she's making little over $8 an hour. That's unconscionable. There is no reason why they can't have a penny a year, 1% a year, something.
Joelle, I appreciate your call. Reihan, we had Ron Unz on yesterday, conservative millionaire out of California, saying something similar. Raise it. It'll pay for itself. I guess the question is the same one. Will the GOP be able to resist this as we get closer to election time this fall?
Well, Tom, keep in mind that one of Ron Unz's goals is, he believes that it would actually be a good thing for many less skilled immigrants to not climb on those first rungs of the economic ladder. He believes that raising the minimum wage enough would make the U.S. labor market less of a magnet for less skilled immigrants. When you're looking at the number of people who are earning the minimum wage as a share of the workforce, you're talking about, about 3 or 4% of the workforce. There are a fair number of people who are making less than 10-10 as well, so that becomes a bigger pool of people. But an important thing to keep in mind is that the United States has over 300 million people, and you have big differences in labor markets from one place to another in terms of what the average wage is. So when you sharply increase the minimum wage, the thing is that it's going to have very different implications in one labor market versus another, which is one reason why you have many states that are moving ahead independently. Having a federal minimum wage that winds up being much higher than the statutory minimum wages that you have in many states right now is going to have an uneven impact, including a pretty uneven impact on net job creation across different jurisdictions. So I think that we have to respect the fact that the United States is a very big and diverse country with lots of different local labor markets. This is not popular. And I think that you're probably right, that Republicans will make some kind of concession. I think that it's going to be very hard for them not to. I'm not sure if we're going to get to 10-10. But I think that it's a sad thing, because I think that the really pressing issue is the fact that you have a lot of people who aren't getting into the labor market in the first place. You have a lot of people on the margins of the economy. And I think a strategy that emphasizes wage subsidies is a much better way to draw people into the economy rather than a strategy that bans paying people lower training wages.
Kristen Welker, I know we have to lose you in just a minute here. Do you see a strategy behind the rhetoric last night? He had to shape something pretty carefully to get up there, you know, after such a rough year and stand before the nation. But does he have a kind of some kind of jujitsu buried in here that you think may work for the White House?
Well, I think what the White House has to do is stay focused on this message if this is, in fact, what they want to have happen. One of the big criticisms is that the president has trouble staying focused on one topic. He did it very effectively during the payroll tax cut fight, for example. But then on some other issues, you hear him talk about it. He'll tout a proposal and then move on to another topic the next day. What's interesting about this issue, Tom, is that if you look at the polls, a majority of Americans actually support some of the keys of his parts of his agenda. 51% say they want to see the minimum wage go up. So I think the strategy and what the White House is preparing to do is to hold a number of events talking about this, focusing on it, pressuring Republicans. But still, there's no guarantee it's going to pass. You'll recall gun control. More than 80% of people wanted to see new gun measures passed, and it still didn't make its way through Congress. So I think that that's the strategy. Will he follow through with it? That's the big question. And I'm so sorry that I have to leave you early.
It's quite all right. Kristen Welker, White House correspondent for NBC News. Thank you very much, Kristen.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Tom in Ashland, Kentucky. You're on the air, Tom. What do you think?
Yes, well, I've been hearing a lot of discussion for many, many months and years now. Your program is excellent. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
However, I have found that, what at least from my point of view, that we're talking about an argument, perhaps, between what are known as conservatives, Republicans, and liberals, Democrats. And really what the issue is that the Republicans have pushed back on anything and everything that Obama has tried to do. Obama knows the situation, as do most Americans. But essentially, instead of it being somebody's argument for or against whether we should or the country should continue to support the upper brackets and leave the others behind, it is not so much an argument as to whether it succeeds or fails, but rather it is they know full well what they're doing all along. They know exactly what they're doing. They love having people under their thumb, but even if it means that they lose everything.
But how do you leave the bottom behind, Tom, and keep winning in a democracy?
No, I'm saying they have.
It's just a done deal?
They've left the bottom behind, excuse me,
yeah,
because they know full well what they're, that it's not a matter of in the Reagan years that they were failed, that was a failed approach or anything.
You see it as deliberate now, Tom. I think we've got it in our time grow shirt. I really appreciate your call. One more right here, Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. You know, this whole program really speaks to the irrelevancy of our government, to the irrelevancy of the presidency and the Congress. We have such huge issues on the environment, the economy, foreign affairs.
Yes, we do.
And the president really has really not touched on them, neither has the Congress. And for me, I guess the key is Louis Brandeis's comment about, I'll paraphrase because I don't quite remember it,
mm-hmm,
that you can either have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, or you can have a democracy, but you can't have both. Right now, we have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few. That's the problem. Until that changes, programs like this are just going to be bad sport that will take a second fiddle to the Super Bowl.
Sam, I appreciate your call. I hate to be second fiddle to the Super Bowl, bad sport. But, Amy, you know, you can hear the sourness there. And there was a kind of sour feeling overall last night, I thought, but the sourness in watching and thinking, you know, this isn't even good sport anymore. We've got troubles, and they're not being addressed.
Well, again, I think that it is the feeling in America that you're working hard, and the things that are supposed to be happening as a result aren't happening. And that's, again, where the minimum wage comes in. I do think that people want a chance to be able to go to work and earn a decent wage. Ryan mentioned how there's different standards of what that means across the country, but the idea of the minimum wage is that there's some baseline and that it'll push things in one direction in one market, another in another, and it'll do that, economists have found, without really hurting the number of jobs that are out there, at least at the levels we're talking about, because the minimum wage is so low. It is interesting to hear that sort of distance people seem to have from what the way the economy works and could work for them, and the disdain that they are beginning to have for politicians and fear that there is directed at them by politicians. We've been talking about the earned income tax credit and Republicans talking about that. But that was also the whole idea that there are people who end up not paying federal taxes because of these tax credits. Those people came in for, from Mitt Romney, from a lot of people in the Republican Party, for sort of like, these people aren't contributing, and they are contributing. They have a sense that they're working hard, and they want to have a decent life. And that sort of very basic sense is, I think, what Obama was trying to get at. There are so many other issues that he didn't quite managed to really address in the speech. Again, guns, which is so volatile. And
barely
so
touched on. And we have people saying, come on, let's go to guns. Raihan, do you think, you heard the Republican response, does that resonate in the, you hear our listeners in this hour, Raihan.
The really great thing is if we don't talk about the Affordable Care Act for the president. That's really key. And if some of the claims that he made regarding Medicaid expansion are not contested, I think that's very useful for the president. And I think that that's
He indicated last night that's kind of his strategy. He didn't talk much about it. And he said, hey, you don't want to fight that battle again, Republicans.
Oh, well, you know what? I think that they absolutely do. And I think the country wants to talk about it. And I think it's a shame that we didn't get a chance to address it today.
But yes, it is indeed. We can't get to everything here. It will be big in 2014 from the Republican side. And the president will sooner or later have to be fully defending it as well. Raihan Salam with the National Review. We're very happy for having you today. Thank you for joining us this hour, Raihan. And Amy Davidson at The New Yorker. Amy, thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.